Thank you for the introduction, Michelle, and I'd like to thank actually Michelle for giving me this opportunity. So actually, believe it or not, I've been in Toronto for 12 years, but this is actually my first time here. So, today I'm going to sort of going back to sort of magnetism and talking specifically about honeycomb lattice quantum magnets with a strong spin orbit coupling. So this sort of directly follows up Roderick's talk about the Kitaev model. So let's see. And I'll basically present sort of experimental side of this story about the Kitaev model and in the real materials. So so we are obviously motivated by the Kitaev model, and then many people in this field, we started working on the iridates, so the honeycomb lattice iridates, sodium iridium oxide, and so on. But early on, actually, we quickly realized that actually there is a limitation in studying these iridates because of the experimental technical difficulties of neutron scattering and so on. So we sort of were looking for material which can be studied using neutron scattering, and so. Quite early on, actually, we found that this alpha ruthenium chloride in 2011 or so, and then that's where we sort of tried to synthesize these materials and understand its magnetic and other properties. And sort of in the last couple of years, actually, it was quite interesting to see actually this gaining a lot of attention from a lot of other researchers, and sort of we are actually now catching up, trying to catch up actually with a lot of other. Work. So the story that I'm going to tell you today is more or less a status update of what we've been working on on this front, including actual iridates and ruthenium chloride. So wait, why does it need? Okay, it worked. It worked once. Okay, so I was pressing the wrong arrow. Okay, so like many experimental work, and actually these days more theory work, that we benefited by collaborating with a lot of people, and then this work, as I mentioned, has been sort of going through a generation of PhD students. So the first generation of work was done by Lina Gradason and Ken Plum. Lina did the Rick's work on the iridates, and Kemp was the first. The person who started growing actually ruthenium chloride, and that is now carried on by Jennifer Sears, my current PhD student. And we actually were able to get a lot of beam time in many different beam lines where we can actually do a lot of work on these materials. And the samples, the iridate samples, were provided by Yogesh Singh and Philip Gegenwart. And then we were able to grow our own ruthenium chloride crystals, and then we were able to actually collaborate with Dan Dessau's group on ARPIS studies of this material. Okay, so the brief outline of the talk looks like this. So I'll give actually, so it's great that Roderick gave such a nice introduction to the Kitaev model, so I don't actually have to go into detail about this. So I'll just provide sort of experimentalist point of view of what Kitaev model frustration arising from this gives you. And I'll talk about the iridates and ruthenium chloride, and this is more or less my main topic of this talk, it will be. Okay, so so here's actually my sort of way of understanding this the physics of Kitaev thing. So and then sort of it ties to sort of nicely to the frustration aspect. So this is everybody's favorite cartoon picture of a frustration. So you have a triangular sort of motif with sort of antiferromagnetic interaction. You can satisfy all these bonds, and therefore there is a geometric frustration. So. So the Kitaev model, as Roderick said, was that there is a bond. So in the honeycomb version of this model, there is a three types of bond which actually gives you a different actually preference for these spins to align in certain directions. And that, to me, it feels like this type of frustration is you are not satisfying all the bonds at the same time, so therefore it's a bonds frustration. And in this case, each side is actually frustrated because of these the interaction between these the neighbors are sort of not satisfied at the same time. So the well-known interaction in this case is, of course, we are talking about Heisenberg interaction, which is isotropic interaction between the spins. And then this type of interaction is now famously called the Kitaev interaction, which sort of a more descriptive name is bond-dependent and anisotropic interaction. And of course, in real materials, Heisenberg interaction never exists on its own. It usually exists with the other sort of terms, single ion anisotropy or exchange anisotropy or Jaworzynski-Moria interactions and all these things. And some of these things actually do change magnetic behavior qualitatively. And sometimes it's actually just a quantitative change, and therefore the Heisenberg interaction is the more important interaction in many of these cases. So Kitaev model, as I'll sort of skip through this. So it is exactly a solid model. It has a gapless spin liquid ground state, and then the elementary excitations is Majorana fermion. So let's actually just quickly move on to talk about the experimental systems. And so there is a great and interesting exactly solved model. Can we actually do anything with this experimentally? And can we find a material that can satisfy this type of sort of very interesting exchange interaction conditions? And so if you think about quickly that the Heisenberg, so quickly about this, it's actually quite difficult to realize something like this with just your traditional spin model. Right? So if you spins are isotropic, therefore when you have just spin here sitting s equal half and s equal half, then the interaction tends to be isotropic, and therefore it is difficult to realize a real Kitaev interaction in that case. However, if you have some kind of anisotropic sort of nature to your spin or sort of quote unquote spin, then you can actually have an anisotropic interaction. And that sort of means that we need to have some kind of spin orbit coupling. And it was quickly suggested by Jacqueline Kilulin, and so actually, that you can actually realize this type of Kitaev interaction. And of course, there is always Heisenberg component to this the real materials. Therefore, so Kitaev-Heisenberg model can be realized in honeycomb lattice iridates, such as sodium iridium oxide or lithium iridium oxide. And then they actually solved this and mapped out the phase diagram going from Heisenberg limit to Kitaev limit. And in the pure Kitaev limit, you will have spin liquid, and pure Heisenberg model, you will have nil ordering. In the middle, you have some kind of magnetic order. And the reason why iridates are sort of important and interesting for this aspect is because iridium is where you find the large spin orbit coupling, and which is of comparable order to the spin, the electron correlation, and actually many other energy scales. So it's becoming actually quite popular area of materials physics, where not only honeycomb lattice, but the square lattice or pyrochlore lattice iridates have been studied. Is being studied actually by a lot of groups. And revisit and actually remind you that what's happening in this material is that, so iridium in almost all these materials has a 5d5 electronic configuration, which means that you have 5 electrons in d orbitals. And in the presence of a very large crystal field excitations, then you actually can have a low spin configuration where all the electrons fall the T2G states. So because the energy scale of a crystal electron field is so large that actually you can map this system into effective spin or effective angular momentum, orbital angular momentum one state. And that means that you have actually one hole instead of five electrons. So, and by turning on the spin orbit coupling, you can actually, and you end up with basically a Cramer's doublet of a effective J equal half system. So there we actually turned, or sort of it changed the spin, effective spin into spin orbit coupled J equal half entity. And that allows us to actually realize this Kitaev type of bond-dependent anisotropic interaction, because when you actually have effective J rather than spin, then you mix up with orbitals, and then your actual spin looks like this, isospin looks like this. OK, so let's move on to the experimental realization. So the first one that's proposed by the Shakili and Kalulin and also quickly actually synthesized by Philip Gegenwart's group and Yuge Singh was that this sodium iridium oxide, this actually has the edge-sharing octahedra of iridium oxygen. And based on the calculation, it sort of should be realization of Heisenberg-Kitaev model. And that's what sort of naively thought about, naively expected from the theoretical calculation. But it turns out that there are a couple of surprises on the way, and that made it actually very difficult to study this material. First of all, there was a resonant X-ray experiment that showed that the magnetic ground state of this material turns out to be so-called zigzag antiferromagnetic order. And that actually was the first surprise, because I told you that if you take just a pure Heisenberg-Kitaev model and then find out what the ground state looks like, then you actually find Neel or Stripe order, so there's some order, but this is different from so-called zigzag order. So that actually raised the immediate question, what's really going to, what's happening here? Actually, I had this over here. And so there's no zigzag phase in the pure Kitaev model, so a pure Kitaev Heisenberg model. And so the solution proposed was a large second or third nearest neighbor interactions. Or actually, if you take the typical, or the original, actually, this calculation was done with the ferromagnetic Kitaev term with antiferromagnetic Heisenberg term. But if you actually reverse the sign, then actually you can realize this type of ordering. So there were these discussions about what's happening in this material. And so of course, Jeff is somewhere sitting here, and so his thesis was basically trying to figure out what is the more general phase diagram when you actually consider both positive, the antiferro and ferro, or Kitaev and Heisenberg model. Okay, so then you need to actually, so then everybody knows that actually it is very difficult to really fully understand the magnetic Hamiltonian just relying on the ground state. So you actually need to do some spectroscopy studies to understand the excitation spectrum. Then that actually leads to usually the full understanding of magnetic Hamiltonian. So for this, to understand or resolve this issue, you need the excitation spectrum. And there comes the second problem of this material, which is iridium is notoriously difficult to study with the neutrons because of the large neutron absorption cross-section. And that's and it's actually, it's been a while, and people actually have tried this, and then it's really, there is nothing you can do with the neutrons, not much you can do with the neutrons in terms of excitation spectrum. But about at the same time, actually, about 4, 6, 7 years ago, that there is actually a new kit on the block, per se, which is a resonant inelastic X-ray scattering, comes along with a very high resolution for X-ray spectroscopy, which actually were able to measure magnetic excitations in a lot of these iridate compounds. So that's actually something that we tried and then looked for magnetic excitations in this material. So sodium iridium oxide, so the same material where we were talking about, we actually carried out magnetic excitation measurements using resonant inelastic X-ray scattering. So what I'm plotting here is just a regular intensity versus energy transfer, or energy loss in this case, spectrum for different momentum transfer values in this material. And immediate thing that you can see is that there is nothing much you can talk about this. And the reason is because the energy resolution of RICS, although it is actually better than, say, 10 years ago by order of magnitude, still it's not enough to actually address some of the interesting physics that's happening in this particular material. So to give you some idea that the energy resolution of this particular experiment was about 30 or 35 millielectron volt, and that's why you see that you can resolve this. There are two features. So one around zero energy loss, and then another one that's a sort of bump around around 50 millielectron volt. And it turns out that these two features are made up of actually three components. So I can't actually go in detail why actually we think it's a three component, but for now, actually, for the interest of time, I'll just explain what it is. So basically, you have elastic background and also have a phonon background, which sort of follows distinct Bose-Einstein sort of Bose population factor. And then on top of that, you have magnetic excitations that we can actually subtract by some temperature-dependent studies. So the on the right-hand side is basically subtracted the intensity, which we believe is a purely magnetic origin. So you can see, and this is actually low temperature. So both are actually 10 Kelvin. So you can see actually this magnetic excitation shows us some dispersive behavior. But again, we are limited by the actual resolution, and this is almost resolution limited, but still it is very broad. So this actually suggests that we can look at the magnetic excitation. So within our limit, we can map out the magnetic excitation spectrum, which looks like this. And that, if you compare with some theoretical calculations, for example, which was done by Kalulin group, that this measured magnetic excitation spectrum corresponds to this red region or the red box here, and then you can see that the dispersion should be constant from gamma to this direction, and on the left hand side it should be sort of going down. So there is a qualitatively you can say that there is some correspondence between this theoretical calculation and this dispersion relation. But I'm the first one to admit that because of the resolution, it is very difficult to say anything quantitative or anything concrete about the magnetic excitation spectrum in this material. So that's why our next topic comes in, and that's alpha ruthenium chloride. And the original motivation for us was definitely it is neutron friendly, and it is actually quite well known semiconductor since 1960s, and it has been used as a catalyst of in chemistry sort of literature. So if you actually search this on Google Scholar, it actually mostly comes up as a chemistry in chemistry papers. But what we found was actually, if you look at the structure of this thing, it looks exactly like the honeycomb lattice iridates that we just looked at. Instead of oxygen, we have a chlorine. That's the only difference. And as long as you were talking about the plane of this thing, and another thing is that you have the chlorine, the ruthenium chlorine octahedra that looks like this, and the structure, at least the published structure, tells us that it's almost an ideal structure, so no local structure near the ruthenium ion. And that is actually quite important, because I told you that the reason why the Kitaev model is realized in these strong spin orbit coupled materials is because of the spin orbit coupling is the main actually energy scale that splits the T2G electron levels. And that's why it gives the J equals half state, which is our spin in this real material. But if you go to the ruthenium, you have to worry about the fact that ruthenium has a smaller spin orbit coupling, bare spin orbit coupling, than iridium. So then you actually have to question whether or not it is indeed a J effective equal half state, or it is just a regular spin half or spin a low spin ruthenium ion. And one of the first actually clue for us is that this very high symmetric arrangement of ruthenium chlorine octahedra, and that allows us to say that, okay, the crystal field that is competing with the spin orbit is actually quite small, therefore it must be so there is a very good chance that this is a J equal half state. And we did actually manage to grow a single crystal, and we obtained the optical spectra, and I'll skip this. And we were able to actually confirm this by doing X-ray absorption spectroscopy. And so without going into detail, there are two actually L etches, which is the 2P etches of the X-ray absorption spectroscopy, and their line shape looks different only when there is a strong spin orbit present, and which actually governs the selection rule when you have a strong spin orbit coupling. So this actually X-ray absorption spectroscopy confirms or at least supports our idea. It's a J effective half model works in this case. And this is another quantity called the branching ratio. And if you have this quantity, which is deviating significantly from the value 2, then that also suggests that it is a strong spin orbit coupled system. And both the ruthenium chloride powder and crystal seems to show that it is significantly deviating from this compared to other ruthenium standard materials. Okay, so let's say that so we confirmed that it's a J effective half system. And we did the magnetic measurements, and then it shows, first of all, very strongly anisotropic response to this. And then you actually can see that there is a sort of small a peak here, which is suggesting there is a magnetic order. And then you can actually fit this to a Curie-Weiss temperature, Curie-Weiss fit, and the in-plane. The susceptibility actually gives you ferromagnetic Curie-Weiss temperature, and out of plane, the fit gives you antiferromagnetic Curie-Weiss temperature. And you can also, so this peak here, actually, I told you is magnetic peak because you can, magnetic order corresponds to this, and then we did the neutron scattering experiment on this material, and we found that actually there is a very small magnetic peak, and it's small because actually our samples are actually quite small. And it has actually this order parameter like behavior, which has a magnetic order around 7 or 8 Kelvin. Just to use my hand. Oops. Okay. This is actually first what we found. So it shows magnetic behavior, which is very much like sodium iridium oxide. So there is not only they look similar in structure, magnetically they behave very similarly. And that also is a very good sign because that we believe that sodium iridium oxide is a good realization of a Kitaev-Heisenberg model, and ruthenium chloride seems to be actually showing similar magnetic behavior. But the story is not all very nice because one of the problems we found was that ruthenium chloride tends to grow in this. This is a crystal structure. Looks how it looks like. It's a very nice hexagonal structure, but they grow in very much like a layered structure. And it's actually mechanical property of ruthenium chloride is very much like a graphite or any other 2D materials, which is actually another connection to the previous speaker. So the problem is that means that when you grow these crystals, they tend to have a large amount of stacking faults. So in other words, the layers of this honeycomb lattice are bonded between the bonding between these layers is a very weak van der Waals bonding. Therefore, when you actually grow this thing, they tend to grow in sort of random stacking, or sometimes you can grow in good stacking direction. But overall, there is a sort of a stacking disorder that you have to take into consideration. So here's actually a good example of our first neutron experiment. So this is magnetic peak. But if you measure this magnetic peak, this is an in-plane scan. But it shows actually quite broad range of this intensity. So this along the L direction, which is direction perpendicular to the honeycomb plane. And we can actually fit this with a sort of a random stacking between well known for graphite, which is a so-called Hendrix-Teller calculation, and we can actually fit this very well here. And another actually thing that we noticed in terms of structural problem or structural origin is when you actually look at this, I mean, they look pretty nice here, but in this susceptibility, you have this kink observed here. And in the beginning, we didn't actually pay much attention to that, but quickly realized that it is actually something more significant because in many of these materials, it turns out that there is a structural phase transition. And So if you actually look at the magnetic peak, for example, not magnetic peak, structural Bragg peak of at located at 1119 and 1118, and they actually show this temperature dependence around 170, 180 Kelvin, one of them goes up and the other one goes down. And you can actually show that this has a fairly large hysteresis. So this is the cooling, and this is a warming scan, and they show about 50 Kelvin hysteresis, which is also consistent with the susceptibility thing that we observed. So there's some hysteresis of a structure which is affecting this thing. More important for that is probably the implication for magnetic modeling. I said in the beginning was that based on the room temperature structure, we could say a lot of these interesting things about the magnetic magnetism of this material. However, if there's a structural transition, does that really change what's happening at low temperature? Because we actually don't have low temperature structure. So that's actually what we set out to do. Okay, what is really the low temperature structure of this material? And so it turns out that it's much more difficult than we originally thought figuring this out. So room temperature structure can be thought of as a sort of a stacking of these honeycomb layers in sort of one direction. So this is described with the so-called C2M crystal symmetry. And you can sort of envision that sort of this is looking at the reciprocal lattice, AB reciprocal lattice, and you can actually think of this stacking of the second layer with respect to the first layer as sort of this displacement vector, which is you can place in this AB plane. And so displacement vector of this one is minus 1/3 0 in this case, and you can sort of translate this back into this brilliant zone. It's 2/3 0. Okay, so what's really happening, it turns out, is this structural stacking shows very large change somehow. Actually, I don't know the origin of this. Somehow, at high temperature and low temperature, there is a big difference difference in how these layers stack. So at high temperature, as I showed you, there is this stacking, so which means that this is a bottom layer, the top layer looks like this, and so on. That's basically stacking, and you can do a Fourier analysis mapping of this, and that sort of maps out to particular space in Q, which actually tells you what is the translation vector in this case. However, if you go to low temperature and do the Fourier analysis of all your diffraction peaks, then it gives you a particularly two possible stacking directions, and that means that in real space, the next layer stacking actually happens like this. So it actually goes to the center of the honeycomb rather than stacking along this direction. So that actually is quite different, because obviously there will be small interaction between the layers that is important for the magnetism, and that seems to be the case. So we are still understanding what is the implication of this structure. And in the meantime, we were able to do some measurement on electronic structure using ARPES. And so this is the sort of theoretical, the cartoon picture of what the electronic structure looks like. So this is an ARPES study done by Dan Dessau's group. And it's actually a quite nice surface. And you can actually find a very flat band near the Fermi surface. And the bottom line here is the band structure looks very much like the calculation done with the LDA plus SU spin orbit coupling plus U, but with magnetic ground state. And you might say that, okay, so that's not surprising at all, and it is as expected. However, these measurements, ARPES measurements, were done at room temperature. So somehow, at room temperature, ARPES says that the electronic structure is consistent with magnetically ordered the electronic structure, which with the magnetic ordering temperature about 14 Kelvin. So this suggests that the magnetic correlation seems to be somehow persisting up to very high temperature. And that actually is probably, it seems to be consistent with other spectroscopic studies like Raman scattering and optical studies and so on. So So this is a, so this also is a suggestion of the energy scale of a cation interaction might be quite large compared to what we thought about so far. So I'll probably go to this sort of. And yeah, so this is a sort of a recent neutron, inelastic neutron experiment done by Oakridge group, and which is also sort of suggestive of cation interaction. And here's a Raman scaling study done by Ken Birch's group, which is also sort of suggestive of cation interaction in this material. Okay, so we are in the process of doping this thing, and I'll skip this so that you can ask questions. And this is my summary.
Thank you. So, two questions.
So the J effect of a half is a consequence of weak crystal field effects, you know, because the spin orbit coupling actually is much lower than in iridate, right? So, is there any possibility that you could extend that to even 3D, like a 3D5 system, or is that? It's surprising that you could get the J effect of the strong spin orbit physics in a 4D system.
So in terms of energy scale, right, so the 5D iridium, the spin orbit coupling lambda is usually considered as about 500, 400 millielectron volts. And in the ruthenium case, actually, it's smaller, but it's not that small. It's actually about 100 millielectron volt. So compared to that, the 3D case is usually, so it's less than, I mean, it's probably 20, 30 millielectron volt or even less than that. I think the cobalt case is probably the largest, and it's tens of millielectron volt. So that's basically where you have to sort of think about. To actually bring this back to the question, to elaborate what I told you about and then what Bruce talked about was, So the whole thing here relies on sort of this atomic picture. Of course, when you go to the hybridized systems, it becomes different. But in very naive picture, what matters is that how good is this approximation? If they are mixed in together or somehow mixed in with other things, then this sort of completely J effect of half picture breaks down, and then you can actually not say much about the Kitaev or other spin orbit driven physics. So this is important, and you can see that sort of the way actually this can be isolated from other state is that spin orbit coupling is large, and that has to be larger than the splitting of other states here. And so if this spin orbit coupling is smaller, as in ruthenium, then the splitting between these T2G levels due to other non-cubic crystal field has to be even smaller than spin orbit coupling. Okay, so that's basically where the energy balance comes in. I think it is actually just a material dependent. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some material which is perfectly symmetric to have, say, the crystal field, the non-cubic crystal field, less than 10 millielectron volt. Maybe actually then you can actually have a spin orbit interaction effect there. But you know that almost all the materials, there's no ideal structure, right? So that's, it seems like this is a kind of a limit where you can see spin orbit physics.
Okay, so I think we're going to call it a quit and have lunch, which is on the second floor and until 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you.